Okay, I want to present today some results. I received an honorarium for reviewing an FDA drug application. I'm going to talk update on some of the findings of an 18-year, very large study, about a $45 million study. It was mostly congressionally mandated funding, about Gulf War illness or Gulf War syndrome. Let's see, will this point?
It will.
Can you see that?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. During the 1991 Gulf War, there was a five-week air war from 17 January to 24 February 1991, and then followed by a five-day ground war, 24 to 28 February. And during that period, early in the air war, the third night of the air war, the U.S. and coalition forces bombed the Iraqi very large chemical weapons production and storage facilities at Muthanna, Fallujah, and surrounding areas. The next morning, tens of thousands of nerve gas alarms sounded among U.S. troop positions, and sarin, nerve agent, as well as a little bit of other agents, were detected at these flask-like points over the next week. And then after the war, after the ground war, about 10 days after the ground war, this area here, Kamisiyah, a large ammunition depot of the Iraqis, was demolished by engineers who blew up some chemical weapons loaded into artillery shells. And that has been of concern as an exposure point. Among the troops, the U.S. troops shown here in their positions at the third night of the air war, of the troops there, 700,000 troops were deployed. Approximately, it's estimated that somewhere between 15% and 25% became ill in the succeeding months and have remained ill with an ill-defined illness since then. And this is the subject of our study. So the questions to be addressed in all of this research is, one, how do you define Gulf War syndrome? Because this is an ill-defined illness, and so you must have a case definition to study it, and we've done that and validated, as I'll show you. What is the disease process? Is there actually a physical disease, and can we prove it, and what's the nature of it? What caused the disease? Was it deployment stress, as many believe, or a neurotoxic chemical problem? How to diagnose it, how to treat it, and then how to prevent it the next time. Okay, we entered this in 1994, actually at the urging of Ross Perot, who was concerned that this was not being handled. We did a survey, and 249 members of a Navy Seabees unit who fought in, who served in the on the ground in the war, and unable to come up with a case definition, we did a survey of symptoms and did a factor analysis of those symptoms and found that there were three possible different clusters of symptoms, if you will. We called Syndrome 1, Syndrome 2, and Syndrome 3. And these have turned out to be critical in defining the Gulf War illness because Syndrome 1 is fundamentally different than Syndromes 2 and 3, which are probably variants of the same thing. But these three variants of the Gulf War illness were defined this way. The Syndrome 1 was impaired cognition, just a mild cognitive disturbance, but very characteristic. Syndrome 2 was the worst. This was called, we call confusion ataxia. These people have a fairly severe, what we believe is a neurotoxic encephalopathy, and to this day are unable to function and keep a job. The third group are similar to the second group, except focused more on a central neuropathic pain syndrome. Okay, so we believe that this is the picture. The large green circle are all Gulf War veterans, 700,000. And then the next circle are those veterans who have an illness following the war and attribute it to the war, but probably are not due to the war. People who got heart disease or cancer or something and believe it was due to the war, post hoc propter hoc. But then we have these three syndromes, syndromes 1, 2, and 3 that we do believe are due to the war. This case definition, developed by factor analysis, was then validated by structural equation modeling and a goodness of fit test in 335 members, Gulf War veterans, ill veterans at the Dallas VA, and then in a large national survey of 8,000 veterans randomly selected from the 700,000 who went over in a statistical design. Okay, the research began in 1994 with that survey. We then brought in a nested case control study of the ill and some well controls from that unit in 1996, brought them back again in 1998. And this exercise was to raise hypotheses about what the illness was and about what the cause was. We then spent the next 13 years developing a big national survey, which I mentioned, and then pulled that off in 2007 to 2008. And then also with 8,000 subjects interviewed, and then collected blood samples for serum, DNA, and RNA from 2,100 nested case control study, all the sick, and a random sample of the well, and we're doing a gene expression study on that information now. We also developed new set of brain imaging technology that didn't exist, that was necessary in order to understand what the brain problems were. We tested that in the same group that we'd had in 1996 and 98, a pilot study, and then we did a random sample, another nested case control study from the 8,000 in a second confirmatory study of the neuroimaging, and then we did some animal studies and preclinical trials. So that's the let me highlight a couple of the major findings that we've done, looked at over 10 years in this cohort. In 1998, we had this hypothesis. We had evidence that sarin was probably the main cause of this toxic neuroencephalopathy. So if soldiers suffered brain cell damage from sarin nerve agent, low-level nerve agent, sarin is a cholinergic stimulant. It paralyzes acetylcholinesterase and thus produces cholinergic excess. We might expect then to see that an abnormal brain cell response to an experimental re-challenge with a cholinergic agent. So we performed an experiment in cases and controls where we exposed these people to physostigmine, which is a similar cholinergic stimulant, and then followed this with SPECT scans, brain blood flow scans, to see if the sick people responded with brain blood flow differently to a cholinergic challenge than the well veterans. And this was done in that same nested case control study of 21 cases and 17 controls. So here we infused for an hour a saline infusion with placebo, gave the HMPAO SPECT reagent, did the SPECT scan, and got the SPECT scan that you see on the right. We repeated it 3 days later, but spiked the IV with physostigmine, repeated the process, and got a brain scan that was stimulated with physostigmine, then compared the two scans, and then looked to see if the response was different in the cases and the controls. And what we found was, basically, you can see here the controls, the syndrome 1, syndrome 2, and syndrome 3. You see there's a characteristic reduction in brain blood flow in the controls, in the syndrome 1 and the syndrome 3, but a paradoxical increase, which is highly abnormal. This is what you see in a person with Alzheimer's disease, which is also a disease of cholinergic neurotransmission. This is not Alzheimer's disease, but it appears to be a similar defect, probably chemically caused, though. And here's the test of the difference, and you see the syndrome 2s are highly different. We then repeated this 10 years later in that same group as a pilot study, but this time using a different way of measuring brain blood flow using MRI, a technique called arterial spin labeling. And we see here was the original information in 1998. 10 years later, we see a characteristic drop in cerebral blood flow in the controls in the syndrome 1, but an increase in syndrome 2, and now 10 years later, an increase in syndrome 3, and this and other information suggests that represents a progression of this neurodegeneration of the cholinergic part of the brain. And you see down here, the different scores down here are highly different in the syndrome 2 and 3 than the controls in syndrome 1. And then a year later, we then had a nested case control study from a random sample of Gulf War veterans. These are now representative of all Gulf War veterans, and we see exactly the same pattern, decrease in the controls, decrease in syndrome 1, and actually we divided the controls into the non-deployed and the deployed controls, got the same thing, and in syndrome 1, but in syndrome 2 and 3, we got this characteristic but very pathological increase. So we believe this is evidence of damage to the cholinergic nervous system. We then looked at, this is all comparing the blood flow in the hippocampus, the memory part of the brain. We then did a functional MRI study in the hippocampus. This is syndrome 1, syndrome 2, and syndrome 3. Here is, these are well veterans over time, where they do a memory test in the MRI scanner, and you see the little red dot in the anterior hippocampus. This is an area of activation when they're trying to remember a task, and then over time it grows in the medial, the middle of the hippocampus, and then really takes hold in the anterior and middle hippocampus. But down below are the sick Gulf War veterans, and you see no red dots. There's no hippocampal function in this memory paradigm, indicating that Gulf War veterans have damage to the hippocampus as the basis for their memory complaints. This is a mouse study in our preclinical studies showing that 1 week after mice are exposed daily for 10 days to 5 or 10 days to chlorpyrifos, a pesticide, an organophosphate pesticide that has similar effects to sarin and organophosphate. In the acute effects, a week after the exposure, compared to the controls, which are the solid squares, the ones who were exposed had an increase in synaptic transmission. The brain synapses in the hippocampus were faster than normal. This is an acute stimulatory effect. But in the ones, but 3 months later, compared to the controls here, who are the solid squares, 3 months later, you see a dramatic degradation of hippocampal synaptic transmission velocity. And with EMs of the synapse showed degeneration or reduction in the number of synaptic spines in the CA1 pyramidal neurons. This was published recently in Toxicologic Sciences. So what we see here is, and this is just an example of, we've also done human neurological studies of autonomic function, a complete autonomic battery, including a 24-hour Holter monitor calculating high-frequency heart rate variability, and found that, which is a measure of pure parasympathetic function, which is called the cholinergic part of the autonomic nervous system. This, too, is abnormal in sick Gulf War veterans compared to the well veterans, was true in 1998, and it remains true, and in a representative sample of Gulf War veterans has been demonstrated now and will be published at the end of November. So what we see is that, in summary, We over this period of years, we've now narrowed down what we believe the Gulf War syndrome is, this group of symptoms that are difficult for veterans to explain, appears to be an abnormality, a damage to the cholinergic nervous system that affects hippocampal function, memory, as well as parasympathetic function and all of the bodily functions that are maintained by the parasympathetic nervous system. So,
thank you.
That's where we are.
Do we have time for? We do have time for one question. Are there any questions or comments for Dr. Haley? Yes, one question right here. Please, please stand up if you would. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, you know, this is a difficult thing to discuss for our country to discuss openly because it has to do with, you know, very sensitive military things. My understanding is the military is very aware and the our chemical defense groups are very aware of the possible long-term effects of nerve agent and are working on various antidotes and things. I don't know exactly what the status of that is, but it's certainly, and I think this evidence now, this has been very difficult to study, to know what the illness is and know where to go to study. It's taken us 18 years. This is going to be very helpful, though, to our chemical defense people to know what the disease is so that they can develop better animal models and develop preventive issues.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.